I'm presently at University of Minnesota. I'll come back to that in just a couple minutes. I've been there almost 5 years, but before that, I was 22 years at University of Arizona, which is in Tucson, and for a fair amount of that time, I was a liaison. So I have done traditional liaison work, and I did some newer kinds of liaison work, and have quite a bit of experience in that particular arena. At Minnesota, my title is Associate University Librarian for Academic Programs. And that's, you can think of that as roughly equivalent to AUL for public services. Academic programs is a term that Wendy Luger, who's our university librarian, our director, chose. She's been there a couple of years longer than I have, and she started a reorganization when she came, and she was keen on choosing language that would mirror the language that's used on campus there. And so there are academic departments, and so she created a division called academic programs. Within academic programs, there are six departments. I just want to give you a little bit of sense of what we've got, because I'm using Minnesota and what we're doing there as an example. And we've had some success with a new position description framework, but I am just using this as a case study. It's by no means intended to say that we've got this all figured out or that this is the only way of doing something, because I guarantee you that we do not have it all figured out. So there are six departments within the Academic Programs Division, and four of them are subject-focused. So there's Arts and Humanities, Social Sciences and Professional Programs, Physical Sciences and Engineering, and the last of those is called Agricultural, Biological, and Environmental Sciences. Then Archives and Special Collections is also in the division, and then the sixth one is a group called Coordinated Educational Services, and they do pretty much what their name suggests. They coordinate those things that span all of the other departments in the division. So, for example, they coordinate the chat email reference service. Okay, so that's the setup. That's what we do at Minnesota. And I first gave a shorter version of this talk at the ACRL conference in March in Seattle. I don't know if any of you were there. That's several people who were in Vancouver were there and heard it, and that's what led to this particular invite. I've given it a couple of other times since then. This is longer, a little bit longer than what I did in Seattle. Just to give a little context for what I'm going to talk about today, my brother asked me recently, he talks to me a lot about his work. He's a research chemist. He's a paint research chemist, so he's got this cadre of jokes about how he watches paint dry for a living. and he talks about his work. He really likes it. And he said to me not too long ago, you know, I know you're a librarian, but I really don't know what you do all day. That sounds familiar. So I gave him some answer at the time, but then I went away and I thought about it a lot. And trying to get my head around how would I describe what I do to people, and I ended up that in a nutshell, the vast majority of my job these days is figuring out the future of research libraries or academic libraries, kind of reinventing research libraries is pretty much what most of my time goes toward doing. So that's the context for this talk today. And I do have it written out, but I also tend to kind of go freeform a little bit as we go through this. So as we all know, in the last decade, new technologies have fueled really, really fundamental shifts in the behavior and the expectations of students and faculty. Digital content abounds, and new forms of information access are evolving, giving rise to changes in the way scholars communicate and disseminate their research. Hi. That's okay. We're informal. So as libraries, we've been traditionally focused on the products of research, and increasingly, we're going to have to shift that attention, not that we ever lose those products, but we are also prompted to understand and support the processes of scholarship. And this is it's a paradigm shift, which is kind of an overused term, but very, very apt, I think, for us. And that shift includes a lot of things, also defining new roles for liaison librarians. So I'm going to take the next few slides actually come from Wendy Luger, our director, which are used with permission here. And she originally used these slides in last winter at a talk she gave in Bielefeld, Germany. And it's a quick summary of what we're talking about, the context of what we're talking about when we talk about what is this paradigm shift thing, okay? So in the past, we've been very, very collection-centric in libraries. In fact, somebody told me, one of the people in Vancouver told me they'd been to the Harvard Leadership Program this year, I guess, and she said while they were touring some of the collections at Harvard, one of the librarians there said that they had spent much of their time serving the collections rather than serving the users, and that they really needed to get their head around what it meant to serve the users. And so we are moving from a collection-centered focus to one that gives equal value to the expertise that we bring to the processes of research, teaching, and learning. And my really quick example about this is, and it was so rewarding, I have to say, so gratifying. There's a group on our campus called the Senate Research, or Senate Library Committee, and they are a body of the University Senate. Okay, so this is not a library's thing, it's a university thing. It's largely faculty with a few staff on it. And recently we were facing some really severe, potentially severe budget cuts at Minnesota. We had to model what we would do at 3, 5, and 7% cuts. And so we consulted with this group, as we always do. And the conversation was really fascinating. I was there to hear a fair amount of it. And they talked about the fact that they needed to give advice to the provost about how he should support the libraries, but that he had to understand that it wasn't only the collections that they were interested in, that the collections without the expertise of the librarians were not useful to them, or not nearly as useful to them. And one of the faculty gave an example, and they did. They wrote this letter that they sent to the provost saying, we know there have to be cuts, but we, in the past, you know, it would have been spare the collections, and that's what I went through for decades at Arizona. They gave an example of why they need the librarians as well, and one of the examples they gave in the letter was that the most one of our newer hires, the French and Italian librarian, was working with a faculty member who was trying to organize herself so that she could produce her papers more quickly, organize her citations and her research. And so Kate introduced her to this concept of citation managers, you know, or personal information management tools, and showed her several that were possibilities. And when she worked with Juliet and understood what it was she wanted to do, she recommended Zotero as the one she thought would work best. And Juliet, the faculty member, loved it, just loved it, and said that it really helped her be much more efficient and much faster getting her work done and much better organized. And so it was that kind of expertise that she valued as much as she valued the collections that we had to use. So that was one of the examples that they put in the letter that they sent to the provost. We've been, as I mentioned earlier, traditionally very publication focused. We need to also figure out how we insert ourselves every step of the way in the processes, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. We've traditionally been about trying to control everything, which is not, wasn't a bad thing, the idea of bibliographic control, but it was impossible for us to try to control that tightly, everything. And so now we need to understand that basically when we've got somebody who's searching for content, they're really trying to make sense out of the myriad of choices that are out there, and that we have a role in helping them to make sense, connecting people with content. We always have thought of service as mediation, which doesn't go away, it still is, but in addition we need to think about how we enable people. And that Zotero example is a perfect example of that, how we've enabled people to be better at what it is that they do. And we don't necessarily always have to be there. You know, this enabling thing can be tools that we create or services that they can take advantage of whether we're there or not. And last but not least, we really need to get our heads around the fact that we can't just operate locally anymore. Our faculty, especially at research institutions, their colleagues are all over the world. You know, their closest colleagues could be in an academic department at another institution on another continent, and they need to know increasingly how to work with those folks. And so we're trying to work on tools that will allow scholars to work together in virtual communities and do other things like that as well. So those are the kind of paradigm shifts that we've been talking about at Minnesota and trying to figure out how we serve this and how we insert ourselves into this process. This is a quote that really captured Wendy's attention a few years ago, and we've really pretty much embraced it. It's from Lorcan Dempsey, who is at OCLC, and I think he nailed it. He talks about this getting in the flow thing, and it's kind of become our mantra at Minnesota that we need to figure out how to get into the flow so that we can support the teaching and learning process whenever and wherever it occurs. So that's become kind of our guiding thing here, is getting into the flow. And because of that, our mission statement has changed. And our current mission really affirms that the library is no longer the center of the information universe. Rather, our strategic advantage comes from a broader portfolio of assets. The expertise and the value-added services have become paramount. The university libraries have two roles as leaders in areas such as information literacy, copyright, author's rights, and as a provider of extraordinary information experiences, which is really another way of saying, how do we get into the flow? How do we help students, scholars, and citizens to improve individual productivity and to achieve their goals? And just a quick word about this kind of unusual wording here. They redid the vision and mission shortly before I got to Minnesota. not quite 5 years ago. And we have, when we do anything like this at Minnesota, we have a very staff are involved in the process every step of the way. And so staff got a lot of input into what should the mission and the vision be. And somebody somewhere along the line picked up on, there's an ice cream shop in the States called Cold Stone Creamery, and their slogan was providing extraordinary ice cream experiences. And they... which really resonated with, excuse me, with somebody. And I think some people were not so sure about this at the beginning, but the more they talked about it, the more they decided that they really wanted something different, and they really liked that concept. And so it became part of the mission statement for the university libraries. And it stuck. So it's still the mission statement for us today. So that's the context. That's the background in which we're working. Are there any comments on any of that or questions or... We're good to go? Okay. So, now, you know, we've got this grand vision, and a big mission in front of us, and we're really trying to insert ourselves into the flows of faculty and students and make their lives better. And so, in order to do that, we need to be thinking always about how everything we do moves in that direction, and how everything we do supports everything else, and how all the systems feed each other and support each other. And so this is one of my real interests in life, is this always maintaining a system-wide view and making sure that everything works together in concert. So, you know, you start out with what are the campus priorities, what are the priorities for the researchers, the behaviors that we observe about how people are working and how that's changing. Make sure that our mission and our vision support those things. Well, how do those things happen? I mean, what really literally happens is that the people on the ground have to have job descriptions that have them doing things that are going to achieve the mission, right? And then every year they write individual annual goals that carry out those job descriptions. Then it begs the obvious question of, do people feel comfortable doing what their jobs say they should be doing? Do they have the knowledge, skills, and abilities to pull that stuff off? So are we providing good staff education in order to support them? What resources do they need in order to do their jobs? And ultimately, how do we reward that? How do we recognize and reward what it is they're doing? So all of these things have to work in concert, okay? And when I got to Minnesota a few years ago, there had been several different systems in place over the years before I got there, and there were librarians throughout the division who were essentially doing the same work, but their position descriptions were often radically different one from the other, you know, and they were just products of time, and nobody had looked at them in a long time. So I did realize that one of the things we needed to do pretty quickly was to get those position descriptions in alignment, and we decided to use those in a couple of ways, and one of them was simply to describe the work that people should be doing, and then they're used as a basis for assessment at the end of the year. But the other thing we could do with them is to really start walking people through a process to help them increase their understanding of how the work we're doing is going to change over the years. I really firmly believe that we will not be doing exactly the same work. In fact, we're already not doing the same work as we did when I started or even a decade ago. And it's going to keep changing, and we're increasingly going to be doing new and different work as we go forward if we want to remain viable institutions. I really believe that we won't remain viable if we don't stay current and kind of keep reinventing ourselves, as I said at the front end. So we thought, sure.
Are you looking at beyond the
We are, yeah. And we started with the librarian positions, and we've been through that, and now we're going back, and we've actually done some of this all along, but we are reviewing all the position descriptions for the staff as well. And those are changing too. It's kind of that domino effect. If you change what librarians are doing, then what staff are doing changes. And in libraries everywhere, we're not unique about this, that the jobs at the lowest level are the ones that are going away. And everybody's kind of, you know, the expectations, the responsibilities are ramping up. So we developed this thing called a position description framework. And it is a document. I brought it just so you can see. It's 9 pages long, which is why I didn't bring copies of it. It's really quite lengthy. but it is a framework. And let me say a word about that. was intended as a structural document that then an individual librarian would take and sit down with his or her department director, and they would, from that framework, pull together a position description that applies to that particular individual. Okay? So most of the elements in the position description framework are present in most individuals' job descriptions, but there is some variation. And different people spend different amount of times on those activities. Okay? We first started working with this position description framework 3 years ago, and it was an iterative process to develop it. The six department directors and I drafted it, and then we sent it out to everybody, and I went to every department meeting, and we talked through it, and we got input, and we took the input and came back and reworked it. And we've been working with it for 3 years, and then decided, as we should with all documents that are living, breathing things, that it needed a review. And so we just did that this summer, and there's some new language on here and a couple new categories. The new categories, to be honest, really represent things that we kind of neglected to put in the first time around. It's not totally different stuff. We just didn't recognize things the first time around. So let me say a few words about a couple of these categories, and then I'll step you through some examples. But again, interrupt me if you have any questions. This really does hinge on the fact that we believe that the liaison model is still very, very powerful. Librarians possessing both subject expertise and a strong knowledge of local interest activities, disciplinary knowledge, that kind of thing, is really valuable to the campus. The ability to build strong relationships is critical for most of these new roles, and it's something that good liaisons have always done well. Okay, I should take a minute to say that when I took this job, Wendy was very clear with me that at Minnesota we did not have a bibliographer model. And I think, you know, there were some vestiges of that left when she got there, and she had a very strong belief that the bibliographer model is not the one that's going to serve us or our clientele well going forward, and that we were going to engage a liaison model. So the difference being, I don't know if those are terms you use as much here, but the bibliographers, you know, focused pretty much exclusively sometimes on collection development, and liaisons on a broader range of activities serving an academic department or college. And it became pretty clear to me fairly soon that even though there was, in theory, a liaison model in place, that it had never been clearly articulated. And therefore, if people had any extra time at all, or when they were prioritizing their work, pretty much the collection piece still came at the top, you know, and that's where people were spending much of their time, is with the collections. And so we needed something to help articulate the broader range of activities that we wanted people to be engaged in, so that they would have some sense of what it was, you know, what the expectations were, and what we were moving toward. So the campus engagement essentially means the outreach. What we want people to be doing is developing very strong relationships with faculty, grad students, and then undergraduate programs as well. When we interview people for liaison jobs, one of the standard questions we ask them is whether or not they can make cold calls, which is, yeah, always kind of interesting to folks. But as people talk through that, you get a real sense of, are they okay picking up the phone and calling a faculty member that they don't know? Are they okay calling a department head and asking if they can have some time on a department agenda? You know, those kinds of things. Getting physically out of the library, physically into the academic departments, and trying to build relationships and work with people. And that's a challenge for some librarians. Some folks didn't get into the field to do things like that, you know, and it's different work, and it's a challenge. You'll notice a lot of these things, we're trying out some new language here, and I can't tell you that all of it is firm. In the first iteration of this, the e-scholarship thing was actually e-science, because that's where e-science and data services is where we thought initially we were going to be working. This go-around, we had to broaden it because the digital humanities, you know, there's so much more activity going on there these days that we need to be involved in, so it's a much broader thing. Teaching and learning is the phrase we try to use on campus instead of information literacy, which, not that I don't like that term, but I don't know that it resonates with all the faculty. The first go-round, this content collections thing, and I still don't know exactly what we're going to call that, but it was called collection development and management, which again looked like the same old thing. And really it's not. What we've been working very hard to do is have people broaden their concept of what they're doing in that arena, and not to think of it as, it is not our goal anymore to build the biggest local physical collection that we can. That's not the goal. And we do have a document that uses the phrase that says collections going into the future, collections are not the coin of the realm anymore, which again doesn't mean that they're unimportant. They are and always will be important, but content more broadly is important. So sometimes we buy materials, sometimes we lease them or license them. Sometimes they're free, but we need to know about them so we can connect people to them. And increasingly, we have to do much more cooperative collection development because we are out of space, physically out of space, like many institutions. And really, I think my own conscience tells me that we've got to get better at figuring out how many physical copies of something need to be present to serve a research community, because they're often very lightly used materials. And so now, increasingly, there are some good studies out there. There was an Ithaca study that was done not too long ago, the Ithaca group being the one that did JSTOR and several other things. And they, I'm going to forget the exact numbers, but it's something like 7 copies. You know, 7 physical copies are pretty much all we would need to serve a North American population. If we could, yeah. Wow. Yeah, of lesser used materials. Now, obviously, there are going to be some things that are more heavily used, but if we had 7 distributed copies, that would pretty much meet the needs. I know. It's pretty interesting, isn't it? And you can, and here we are with all of us trying to get all those copies and keep them, and we don't necessarily need to have quite that many.
It just makes me think mm-hmm. of when I check something on WorldCat, and it tells me that over 1,000 libraries
have that. Right.
Like,
I know. Yeah, I know. But, you know, there are other studies that show us that somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60%, and the estimates are that it could be higher, of materials in large research libraries have never circulated. Mm-hmm. Never. Yeah.
I'm just wondering what the publishing world would think when they thought we only need 7 copies of an item. And, you know, so it moves us to a new publishing model.
It does.
Where you're doing digital publishing and you may be charging for the user.
Or right.
Some other way to allow the publishers to get into
to get there, yeah.
The investment. Because we don't want stuff not published.
Absolutely.
That's the best, isn't it?
That's it in a nutshell. I was fortunate enough to be at the, there was a spring conference of the CIC group, which is the Committee on Institutional Cooperation, which is a consortium of mostly Midwestern universities in the U.S. It's, if you're familiar with the Big Ten sports group, it's the academic arm of the Big Ten sports, you know. So, and they did a spring conference, and it was about collections. The focus was on collections. And I did a shorter version of this talk there, too, but we had publishers there. And this is my point. We had a couple of publishers there. And when we all first started recognizing that publication patterns had to change, the publishers were not quite there with us. And I think that's changing a lot. The publishers that came to this thing last spring were very much there and understanding that they don't want to go away either, but they need to come up with some new business models in order to stay viable. So, and I don't know that all publishers are there yet, but I think that all of us are recognizing that we've got a good symbiotic relationship and we want to go forward with that, but the future's going to look different from the past.
So with your library, are you actively collaborating with other universities so that you can make one copy or something?
We're starting. It's pretty basic right now, and there have been many attempts in the past that failed because nobody's heads were there yet. But we did, for example, just do a, we're doing a Google project. We're part of the Google, bigger Google project, but we started a separate one, and we actually started this at our institution, and now we're involving the CIC libraries to digitize United States federal government publications. And we happen to have duplicate copies of a lot of things because we're both a regional and a selective, which I won't bore you with the details. But so we agreed that we would send off all the duplicate federal publications we had off to Google to be digitized, and then they become publicly available because they're public domain materials, right? And so then all of the other CIC institutions, it took a little doing, but they all got on board, and they're now all identifying agencies that they could spare their copies that are going to go into this digital HATI trust, it's called. So.
Mm-hmm. How have you seen it affecting sports tech? Because obviously, you're moving to fewer physical volumes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How are they going?
A couple of things. There was a process improvement effort that happened, and I'm going to get to this a little bit at the end, so I won't talk too much now, but that streamlined what they did, the physical processing piece in the technical services area, and it freed up, I think, two and a half positions as part of that process improvement effort. And those positions, those lines were reassigned to the IT department, the tech folks, because we never have enough tech folks. Now there, they actually had some vacant lines, and the vacant lines were captured and reassigned because the same people couldn't make those transitions. But so that was one thing. The other thing, though, is that their work is changing. We now, this last year, our numbers show us that we got as many e-books as we did physical books last year. Excuse me, and there's lots of work figuring out how to handle electronic records, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's, their work is just shifting. There's a lot of what's going on there. Yeah. Let me see here. What else am I supposed to say about this? The Ask Us services is, and we haven't landed on a word here. This is kind of a placeholder. But again, what it's meant to show is that the students, who are the ones by and large that come in and use our walk-in services, don't understand the word reference. And you, I was in your library yesterday. I came up and walked through, and you don't say reference at your service point. I was so thrilled. I thought, this is it. And we're going to do focus groups. I don't know what labels we're going to use yet, so the Ask Us is kind of a placeholder here. But we're going to do focus groups to find out what the students would call it if they had their druthers. So anyway, and then let me say very quickly here, I'm trying to watch the time. A lot of folks look at this and say, this looks overwhelming. In fact, that's what the librarian said when we first sent it around. But then they added things to it. So, and it can look very overwhelming. But let me point out very quickly that these things are not all equal in terms of the amount of time that they take. So my quick example here is the fundraising one. Let me back up one sec. The way in which the framework describes these things too is to say that a department owns this collection of activities, and they provide services to colleges. That's how we work here. So the Arts and Humanities Department Library Group, for example, serves two colleges on campus, the College of Liberal Arts and the College of Design, which is our architecture group. And so they need to provide this suite of services to those two colleges, and they can do that in a couple of ways. They can either say every liaison will do all of these things, and indeed, every liaison has to have at least a basic understanding of these, so that even if they don't do a lot, they recognize the opportunities, and they hook, you know, whatever faculty member they're talking to who needs a personal information management tool. If they are not really good at evaluating them, but they understand the need, they say, you know what, Kate does this. Let me hook you up with Kate, and she can advise you on how to choose. So they can either say everybody does it all, or they can say, we've got three people who are really good with a scholarly communication piece, and they're going to do most of that work. You know, we've got three other people who really like the teaching and learning piece, and they're going to do a bigger share of that. So the departments have some leeway in how they set themselves up to pull these things off. To date, most of them are doing most of the work. The liaisons are pretty much saying, I want to do this range of things. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask for clarification about the on-demand and advanced services? So does that include things like instant messaging?
And mm-hmm. It does.
So do you have a mobile site? Do you catalog your library website?
We have a chat, we call it chat service. And
but I mean, say you have an iPhone,
uh-huh.
Can you see, is your catalog or your library page customized so it'll work well on that?
We're getting there. Okay. But yeah, they're working on that right now. It's one of the projects underway.
And how do you ensure that all your liaison librarians are up to speed, so to speak, and all these technologies?
Good question. Can I come back to that in a second? Okay. And if I don't, remind me, but I have a slide coming up. So I was going to say, the fundraising one, for example, it's very, very important to us, but it doesn't take a huge amount of time. The other thing we've done is we've hired a few positions that are defined, they specialize, and they're coordinator kinds of positions, and they're purposely designed to support and extend the roles of the liaisons, okay? So we have an information literacy coordinator, we have a media librarian, media and learning spaces librarian, we have a copyright librarian, brand new position that we just hired. We have a development officer and we have a grant writer. And those two people are not librarians. They're specialists in those arenas, but they're not librarians. So they're not going to come up with the ideas for the granting agencies or to pursue donors because they don't know our work all that well. And so the liaisons do two key things here, one of which is idea generation. So we just did a round for the year, and what that looked like was at every department meeting, There was a brainstorming session, and we asked every department to come up with 3 ideas. And so 6 departments, that should have been 18 ideas. We thought that would be enough to get us through the year. People got so into this, we have a list of 199 potentially fundable ideas. Now, obviously, they're not all of quite, you know, same value, but there were so many good ideas on that list. We've gotten 3 grant proposals out the door this summer, and it was just fabulous because, like I said, the people who actually write the grants are not going to come up with those ideas on their own. So that didn't take long. Took a couple hours, but we now have this huge list of potentially fundable ideas. And then our donor, our development officer, she just never knows when she starts working with a new potential donor what's going to resonate with them. That, you know, that's the way they work. I don't know if you spent much time with development officers, but they kind of head out conversationally and listening all the time for what does this person seem interested in. And then the more they've kind of got in their back pockets that they can whip out, the better off they are. So we then write up these 1-page little sheets that Kathy has, and when she finds a donor who's interested, she's good to go. The other thing the liaisons do is when she's got a donor or a potential donor interested in a particular area, she will invite the liaison to either go out for lunch with that donor or do a tour with that donor or something like that. And so again, it doesn't take very long, an hour or two, but it's very, very important to that fundraising process. Okay? So not all equally time consuming, but equally valuable, the things on the list. And here is an explication. This is way too many words for a PowerPoint slide, but I just wanted you to see that each one of these categories in the position description framework does have some explication of what are the activities that might be happening if I was doing this well. Okay? What might it look like? What are some of the expectations for work under this particular heading? So that's what the scholarly communication one looks like. Educating and informing faculty and students, advocating for sustainable models, promoting the University Digital Conservancy is our institutional repository. Okay, so I'm going to go on. I'm trying to pick up here a little bit. The other thing that we did about 3 years ago was to form a bunch of working groups that we call collaboratives, but you could just as easily call them a committee or a working group. And they are made up largely of liaisons. There's sometimes some other folks in them. And we have about a half a dozen of them now in the division. Actually, I think there are 5. And they span, there are people from other divisions as well as we need them. This one was the first we launched. It's called the Scholarly Communication Collaborative. And we did this because we knew this was a very important arena for our liaisons to begin working in. And most of them felt like they didn't really know much about scholarly communication. And so we launched this group. It has been so successful. It's been really probably our most successful working group to date. It's been going the longest, so obviously they've had time to do this. And so I'd like to use some examples of what liaisons are actually doing that has changed what's happening on our campus. So this is the list of arenas in which they're working. They did this thing called a campus profile or an environmental scan, and it was using a tool. Well, let me back up a second. Their first thing they did was to run a series of workshops for the librarians. And originally they wanted to send some folks. There's that ARL, ACRL, Scholarly Communication Immersion Institute, and they wanted to send a few people. But in the end we decided that rather than only being able to send 3 people, fund them to go off, just what we were talking about earlier, why not do a mini immersion institute at home, spend our money bringing the speakers in, and then all of the liaisons went. So all of them went to this training opportunity. It was great. And then but that particular institute generated a tool, this campus profile tool, that we adapted, and then every liaison filled it out for their academic units, academic departments that they work with. And it's looking at things like, is there appetite for alternative models of publishing, say? Do the tenure documents that academic faculty works under recognize alternative forms of scholarship, essentially? Are there potential advocates that we could tap into? You know, all the kinds of things. Are there people who publish in open access journals? Are there editors of journals on our campus that we could work with? And we did find a lot. And so we came up with about 8 people on campus who were willing to loan us both their photograph and a quote. So they created, the next thing they did was created this website for campus called the Scholarly Communicate, Transforming Scholarly Communication. And Gary Bayless, who's the chief, the department chair for aerospace engineering and mechanics, gave us this quote because he really, really got into the institutional repository idea. He really believes it's a very, very important thing to do, And he wanted his professional association to allow faculty to archive their works in the IRs. And they didn't do that. The copyright agreement did not allow that. And so he spent about a year. We consulted with him kind of every step of the way. He spent about a year getting them to where they would alter their publication agreement so faculty can put their journal articles into an institutional repository. So there was a real success story there. We also got the provost and the head of the Academic Health Center to give quotes and photos for the website. This is one of those where, you know, every time you hit the first page, it's a different photo that and quote that gets displayed. So the other thing that the liaisons did, we were a little actually behind the curve in bringing up our institutional repository. Excuse me. And so one of the things that we observed was that the campuses that brought them up empty and then said to faculty, come and put your stuff in, that they would often sit empty for a while. And so we decided we wanted to bring them up chock full of content so that when people looked at them, we did a big publicity blitz. And when people went and looked, they would say, oh, I see the value of this, you know, I get it. And so the liaisons went out and recruited content for the IR, and when it went live, it had 30-some collections in it already from all disciplines. So whether you were humanities faculty or science faculty, didn't matter, you could go in and see something that looked familiar to you. And so we've enjoyed some really quick growth after that, which I really attribute it to the fact that the liaisons did all this content recruitment up front. The other thing that they've done is they worked with our campus office of the Vice President for Research, who does all the training for people who are going to be principal investigators on grants, all the faculty. If you want to be a PI and get grants, you have to go through this training on campus, so, you know, how to work with human subjects, all that kind of stuff. And they, the librarians developed a workshop. We did two, actually, in the last year. One of them was on copyright and author rights, and we brought in Kenny Cruz, who some of you may know. He's a librarian who's also an attorney, and he does a lot of work in that arena. We had 200 faculty attend that because they get credit. They get those, you know, every year the PIs have to get so many continuing education credits in order to stay current as an investigator. And then they developed this one about choices in journal contracts, about trying to keep some of your rights in your journal article contracts. And again, it filled up with faculty. So it was very clever to hook up with this campus office, and we fill up. Every time we offer one of these, it fills up with faculty. So that was very smart of them. And then last but not least, ARL asked us if we would write up how we were going about developing this program on campus. And so the two co-chairs, Chris and Jim, tapped a colleague in California because they wanted to highlight some other institutions as well, and California has done a lot. And they developed this website that's available through the ARL page. Okay, so great work going on with that scholarly communication group, and that was actually work that was done by liaisons in large part. And here's a quick example of something that has been challenging. It's interesting to me about why did the ScholCom one take off so quickly, and I don't know that I know for sure, but I think that the group did a very good job of the initial training effort. I think there was some appetite there. It was new information. The librarians could go out on campus and talk to faculty about something that the faculty really didn't know, and they welcomed hearing it. You know, I've done the author rights talks, and they're thrilled when we come and talk to them about that. They really don't know that they're signing away their rights. You know, it's very interesting to them to learn that. It's been a little slower going with our new instructional role. And here, what we really want to recognize is that on our campus, this is a campus project that resulted in 7 undergraduate student learning outcomes. So the campus is saying when our students graduate with a bachelor's degree, they've got this skill set. They can do these 7 things. And you see number 2 there, the ability to locate and evaluate information. It clearly says library, does it not? And so we know that we need to be there. But what we also know is that our present model of doing teaching and learning, InfoLit, whatever you call it, is by and large, we wait until a faculty member contacts us, and then we go in and we do a one-shot or a guest lecture, whatever you want to call it. Now, it's not that those are wrong or bad. It's just that if the goal is, and we've got 35,000 undergraduates on campus, that all 35,000 of them are going to graduate with this skill set, we can't do it by hit and miss invitation, okay? And we can't scale that one-shot lecture. We've got to figure out how to integrate across a four-year curriculum. And that is a very different role than that guest lecture role. And so the liaisons have had to get their heads around what does that mean, you know? Obviously some online tool development, obviously working with faculty to enhance the assignments that faculty give already to students. We can't always be present in the classroom. So what does it look like? Been a little slower going, I think, for a variety of reasons, one of which is it's harder for us. The faculty didn't know what the SCALCOM stuff. They welcomed our input. Faculty have a much greater sense of ownership over this teaching and learning role. They think they know how to do that, you know. A little harder to get a foot in the door in that arena, but we're working on it. We persist, and I think we will get there. It's just going to be a little slower going. Very quickly, because I mentioned that you saw tool development in the liaison, the list of liaison activities. Quick example here. This is the assignment calculator. Now, the actual programming here obviously was not done by liaisons. It was done by the tech librarians we have, or the tech staff. But the idea for it came from liaisons. And so this is something that faculty can assign, or any student can just go in and use it. And what they do, and we make this available, it's open source, and a lot of institutions have adopted it. And this is the beta version of the next generation. So the students go in and they choose the type of assignment. Originally it was just for papers, but now you could choose a talk, a multimedia production, a lab report. There are a bunch of different templates. And you put in information about when it's due, and then it walks you through a series of steps. It emails the students. It says, oh, it's October 2nd. By this stage, you know, you should have done steps 1 through 3. <You know? laughs> And then it offers them, yeah, I know, it's cool. Students are like, ah. It offers them help. Yeah. And then there's a lot of help here. So there are a lot of websites that the librarians have developed that the students can go to. It suggests databases to them. And we worked with the Center for Teaching and Learning and the Center for Writing and developing this. So there's other kinds of help available in this particular tutorial. Okay. Open source, if you want to use it, you're welcome to. Okay, somebody asked earlier, how did we know that people can do the things that they're supposed to be doing now? So one of the things that we did was to develop this survey around knowledge, skills, and abilities, or KSAs. And then we asked all of the liaisons to go in and fill this out. And they didn't have to give their name. We just asked them to give their department so that they could answer this very freely, you know, and if they didn't really know how to do something, they could say so. And so they filled out this KSA tool, and there's one for every area that was in the framework. So this is the one for scholarly communication. And then we took the results of this, and that's one of the things we've been using to guide the staff education efforts for the last few years, okay? So it is very important to give people a chance to say what it is they need to do and where they feel comfortable and where they don't feel comfortable. And then we need to support that. We just can't throw new things at folks. And the sink or swim method is not typically all that efficient. Another thing that we've done is we didn't have any good across-the-board training for new people. And so this happens to be a different category, the campus engagement. And you can see this is a very drafty document right now, and so you can see that there are notes on it. But what we said was, in the first 6 months that somebody works with us, what do we expect them to be able to do? And so on the expectation is there on the left. And then what people can do is say either, I know how to do that, I'm very comfortable with that, great. You know, you don't have to go through training if you don't need to. But if you don't feel like you could do those things under the expectation, then in the center are activities that are suggested that you could do to help, you know, get yourself up to speed, and then the resources that would be needed over in that last column, okay? So that's another thing that we're trying to do in order to prepare people to do the work. And this can also be used by people who have been around for a while. It's not just for new folks. They could go back and use this too. One more quick example. So this is one of those where we feel like we really have no clue what we're doing, and we're both occupying and inventing a new role at the same time, and it's pretty interesting going. But an effort that came out of the campus vice president for research, the chief information officer, and the university librarian. They recently created this group called the Research Cyber Infrastructure Alliance, and they charged them with exploring research infrastructure needs and evaluating models that might align existing and new resources for more robust and effective support. So this is, how do we support things like data services across a campus? You know, what do we, how do we help faculty figure out how to preserve their data and store it and make it available? So we've got both liaison and technology librarians working with this group, and to date, they've developed a conceptual map of cyber infrastructure components. Going forward, they're going to be developing guiding principles, identifying resource requirements, documenting existing capacity, and evaluating budget models. So these are whole new arenas, you know, and this is where I say we're just really kind of operating on a wing and a prayer right now, and we'll be kind of figuring it out as we go along. And the more that we can share stuff as a community, as a library community, and a higher ed community, the better off we all are, I think, because we really are making this up. We're inventing it. The next obvious question is, what do we stop doing if we've got all this new stuff to do? There are never going to be more hours in the day than there presently are. And so clearly, if there's new work to be done, then we have to figure out how we either do less of or stop doing some of the existing work. I will not tell you we've completely figured that out yet, but we have made some progress, and we continue to try to figure out what we can either streamline or not do. So we did have, I mentioned this earlier, this selection to access process improvement project. And when I got to Minnesota, there was almost no use of approval plans for collection development, almost none. And I'm not sure quite how they managed, but so we did a process improvement project, really ramped up the use of approval plans, and that radically reduced the amount of time that liaisons spend on tile by tile selection. We no longer do an in-house review of approval plan books. They, you know, they had a couple of really small approval plans when I got there, and they would review the books every week. We don't do that anymore. You know, they match the profile, they go into the collection. And we found that we are doing better overall. We've had a lot of faculty input in a few areas where they felt like we weren't getting enough or weren't getting it fast enough, and they really like the use of the approval plans. So then we went to the serials and electronic resources, and we really simplified the workflow, which really reduced the amount of liaison time that somebody had to spend, like if they found a problem, tracking down who in tech services was the right person to deal with it, you know, was very time consuming, and they don't do that anymore. We took all the licensing review stuff and put it back on the licensing librarian. It had been distributed before that, so the liaisons no longer have to do that. Then the other thing that we've done is we're reducing liaison time at walk-in or on-demand service points. And this is the one where we're not quite there yet. We're a little further along in the sciences than we are in the others. But the idea here is that an understanding of the fact that the on-demand services are require different expertise than the expert services. And so at a reference service point, we have a tool called Desk Tracker that we use, and we spent a year capturing the transactions at the walk-in points and then analyzing them. There's also some literature. There have been a couple studies done out there, and they show clearly over and over and over again that somewhere between 90 and 95% of the questions received at those kinds of walk-in points could be answered by very well-trained staff. And they're very repetitive questions, you know. And a lot of them are directional, and a lot of them are tech help questions. And so we don't really need the expertise of the librarians sitting and waiting at those desks. What we need are appointment, you know, by appointment expert help. And so that's what we're transitioning to. And what we've put into place to try to make that smooth as possible, and this is brand new, we've just started this semester, is we're also using Desk Tracker as a referral system. So that as we increase the amount of staff, and we've got great staff, by the way, and we've always had a model where there have been staff and librarians at a desk, and they're often side by side, and the students who walk up to the desk have never known if they're getting a librarian or a staff member, so we've got really good staff already. But now, if somebody comes up to the desk and asks a question that does require some expertise, the staff member will open up a ticket on Desk Tracker, take the patron information, fill out the ticket, and send it off to the liaison. So you don't have that falling through the cracks kind of thing where, you know, in the past the practice was we would write on a piece of scrap paper or give a business card to the student and say, well, here's who you need to call, and then you never know whether or not there's any follow-through. This way we're ensuring the follow-through, and then the liaisons are obligated to get back to the individuals, okay?
Does that happen instantly? Do you send the student up to the liaison or
no,
not?
No. Again, it's the by the appointment thing. Now, it's possible that The liaison is free and available, and again, they do this slightly differently at the different service points. In the science engineering library, they have an agreement among themselves that the liaisons will always have a chat session open if they're in their offices. And so the staff at the desk will send off they can send off a message saying, got a tough chemistry question here, are you available? And if Megan is available, she can help. She'll either help on chat or she'll go down. If Megan's not available, or if she's up there but she's preparing, working with a faculty member or preparing an instruction session and she can't drop everything, then they'll do a referral. Okay?
Interesting.
Yeah.
I have a question about that and how it operates in practice, because just like sometimes students don't know what they don't know,
mm-hmm.
I think the staff at the desk may also not know what they don't know, but over time their expertise develops.
Absolutely.
Because anybody who's service oriented wants to take the student as far as possible before having to do that referral. So how does that work in practice are the liaison librarians still being actively referred to?
Yeah, they are.
People at the desk, over time, actually are able to do more and more expert kinds of questions, and therefore liaisons are less in that.
I think both are true, and I can say this because we also had staff at the desk at Arizona where I worked for many, many years, very similar situation. They do, and that's the beauty of it, is if you have the staff who spend more time at the desk, they do become quite skilled, quite good, and they can answer an increasing number of questions. But there's always a line. I mean, in some areas in particular, there's always a line where I'm not going to, even as a liaison, when I was a liaison and I got some of those tough business questions, there were only so far that I could go with them. But I couldn't have the business librarian sitting at that desk all hours just in case a tough business question came in. So it has to be a part of the training, and we do have to train whoever sits at a desk to understand when to make a good referral. But a really good, strong training program will do that. And do we lose a few? I'm sure we probably do sometimes, but we did under the old system as well. So it has been actually working quite well, and it really both things happen. The referrals do get made, but the staff also get better at it too. So, and I saw another hand over here, I think. Yeah.
I did have a question about the involvement of liaison librarians in inspections, and I'm assuming that the basic function is for the liaison librarian to create the approval profile and then follow the process.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the liaisons, they spend a lot of time on the front end, but first creating the approval plan profile, and then we had to spend some time tweaking it, and it worked better in some areas than others and all that, as you can well understand, well imagine, yeah. So indeed, they control that, and they still do collection development, but it's just less time spent on the routine stuff, yeah. Uh-huh.
So after a year of assessing the types of questions using the desk tracker, to evaluate what your users think?
Think in terms of
the change from on-demand to now?
There hasn't been a lot of change yet. That year was for us to assess what we were seeing in the desk tracker. Then this summer, we used that data. We needed to reduce the number of service points we had in the Wilson. Wilson Library is the biggest. It's arts, humanities, social sciences, maps, government information, that kind of thing. It's our biggest library. There are 6 floors, and we had 13 service points in Wilson Library. I know. Between the reference and the circ points, and we're not that unusual. Libraries have kind of proliferated service points, yeah. We really needed to reduce the number of service points. And so the desk tracker data was very helpful to show us what was happening where by service point, and to indeed assure us that we could consolidate and still handle at many fewer service points handle the questions. So we're down to 7 right now, but we're going to go down to 5, I think, in the building. But we just had to do some transitional work to get down to the other 2. And so that has just started. The consolidation of desks just took place. Yeah, and this fall semester we're starting under the new configuration. But what we want to do is not just ask, we want to do a study this year where we don't just ask the students about what happens at the desk. We keep trying to bring things up to another level. So what we would do is approach the students physically outside of the libraries, if we can in many instances, and say to them, when you're studying, when you're doing a research for your class, when you get stuck, what do you need? And how do you wish you could get it? And where do you wish you could get it? And just to ask them that kind of broader question, so we don't start by asking them focused questions on about a desk. Yeah. So. And that is pretty much the end. This is my last little quote here. We've had to really get our heads around the fact that For a long time, it was a struggle because people would say, well, we can't not do the desk, or we can't not do this. That's our core work. And we've had to recognize that our core work is shifting, and that what's really strategic work for us today could be core work tomorrow, and something else will be strategic. And that's probably pretty much going to be the way it is for us in libraries for the foreseeable future. And that is that's my last prepared slide.
Well, thank you so much. I know people will have questions, and I definitely want to allow that, because we do have some time before we have to go
yes.
to the airport.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to thank you, Karen. I'm thrilled to hear all these different things. And I also realized that I forgot to thank Marnie and the BC Research Libraries group for supporting you coming uh-huh. to see us. And So I don't have a card for you, but I understand that you did get a little gift over in
California. I got a wonderful gift.
That's from us, too.
Ah.
So
yes,
thank you very
that's
much.
What they say, yes.
So if anyone has questions, please feel free.
Or comments, or things you want to tell me about what you're doing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The way that our last couple of job postings have gone are actually trending toward vaguer language around job duties
yes,
rather
yes.
than more specific. So we're actually getting away from the lists of things that you
right,
do
right.
and more toward the, are you a person who can
yep.
figure things out and work with people?
Yeah,
our
job ads read like that too.
Yes.
This is the position description. We don't use all that stuff in the job ad at all. Yeah, and we are looking very much for people who are creative, forward-looking, willing to take risks, good communicators, work well with others. I should mention there are three documents that actually govern what the librarians do. The position description is one, but there's also, we have a continuous appointment process, which is a tenure equivalent process, and there's a document for that. That's the second one. And then we have a third document that I always forget what the official title is, but I call it the Works and Plays Well with Others document. And yeah, and so, yeah, that's the kind of thing we're after.
Mm-hmm.
And we will not, we will prefer those qualifications over a subject degree.
So you're seeing the same kind of trend.
Absolutely.
There's no guarantee that the job you start out with is the job you're
absolutely.
Doing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I had no idea I would be a head of special collections at some point in my career, and yet I did that, and, you know, they report to me now, so. Yeah. Huh?
A couple of points.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had a lot of experience with the programs, but I know that there were far more many books in a particular subject area that I could possibly afford to buy, and it would kind of overwhelm all the other subject areas. So are the profiles getting a little bit more granular so that you can control them better? Because I wonder how, given a fixed acquisitions budget, you can, because, you know, mm-hmm. it seems to me some of those profiles are very broad. For example, I could spend all my money on urban geography, mm-hmm. and it would be gone. Just if I let that approval program run on that profile.
Right.
So I'm just wondering how you manage to, in fact, fine-tune and make those more granular so you can, in fact, get through the year and stuff.
Right. My understanding, and I'm not speaking here from direct experience anymore, I did manage approval plans when I was at Arizona. I don't here, obviously. But they are able to be more granular now than they used to be. And having said that, though, they work better in some areas than others, okay? So some of the areas, there still are firm order budgets. Let me say up front, it's not all approval plan. There are still firm order budgets. We try to pass as much as possible through what we call the big pipe because they come shelf ready and everything, which saves time everywhere, and it gets things to the shelf faster. But really, the key here, I think, is understanding that we're not after perfection, and we say that a lot. We're not after perfection. We've never had it. And you know, there's a famous quote, and I'm going to forget who said it, but the perfect is the enemy of the good. And so we're not after perfection. We do understand that our jobs are to connect people with the content that they need, and we have a variety of ways of doing that. Buying it and having it on our own shelf is one way. But if I don't have it on my shelf because the approval plan didn't pick it up, I have interlibrary loan. You know, or I have an online copy of it, or I have some other way to connect people with content. So part of it is that letting go of, I have to figure out exactly, you know, what the clientele will want, because it's always been a guessing game. You know, we were always guessing about what people would actually use. And as we talked about earlier, you know, more than half of our collections have never left the shelves. So And which isn't bad, again, the research institutions, and we're gambling that someday somebody will need them, but we did have to take that step back and say the goal is not to have everything on the shelf physically. The goal is to connect people with what they want. So you do have to let go. It's that leap.
It's bringing that diversity that's coming in. That's what you've got enough money to get stuff here and here.
We do. It took tweaking. The first year they overspent in some areas, but we knew that. We kind of built that in, and we moved money around. But absolutely, absolutely.
Was there any other?
I just have.
Oh, you did.
This is so much related to liaisons directly. Have you guys shifted collection budgets in any ways to account for more and more interdisciplinary collecting, which seems to be happening here at least? There's so much more in our budgets, you know, departments.
I know.
So that's kind of awkward. Yeah.
It is awkward. No, I don't have a magic answer for that, I'm afraid. We do have a collection development officer who does the big apportioning, and then the collections coordinators in the departments do a level down from that. And then each liaison has their own budgets. And I have heard, we do talk about the fact that that's a tricky one with the interdisciplinarity, yeah. There are some things like a lot of the databases get paid for off the top because they're recognized as being interdisciplinary. But I do know that the liaisons struggle sometimes and they don't quite have their heads around how to do that well. But they are driven by trying to buy what the faculty want. So I do know that they negotiate. There's probably more time spent negotiating which budget line it's going to come out of than we would like. So that remains a challenge for us.
I just had one comment. It was really interesting for me listening to your talk and recognizing where we seem to already be going down some of the same roads.
Yes, absolutely.
But I think we haven't yet embraced the idea of really saying this is a change from what we've been doing. Mm-hmm. We just keep trying to add on.
Yeah.
Without saying, okay, we have to stop doing some of these things.
Yeah.
And we have to look at it in a different way. And the other thing that impressed me was the more partnerships on campus. That a lot of your successes were not just because the library had a committee group doing something, but because they were part of a bigger group on campus. So it's like not just the libraries recognizing the change, but the whole campus is engaged like that. So.
That's so true. I couldn't have said that better. Thank you. That's a great summary. It was interesting to me. Like I said, I did a really short version of this talk at ACRL, and I got such response to it. And I kept saying, why? I don't get it. It was kind of straightforward, and I know that a lot of institutions are doing this already. And I finally landed on, I think it's the gathering it together and articulating it, you know, and the trying to reframe and trying to consciously say, this is where we're going and this is what we're going to stop doing, is really, I think, what's a little bit different about this. It's not that others aren't doing this. And some other places have done far more creative things than we've done. In fact, I often find the smaller institutions are able to move more quickly and more innovatively than we are at the giant state institutions. But I did finally realize, I think, it's just the articulation of it that's been a little bit different. So.
Because, of course, anytime there's a change, it makes people a little uncomfortable. They feel like they're on shaky ground. But when the Office of the Vice President of Research and the library are partners in things, and it's kind of coming from the top and it's coming down, you go, oh, okay, I'm part of this new thing.
Yeah.
I know I'm not just trying to go off on my own. So sometimes I think maybe realizing that, you know, it's kind of stated in a formal way might help people
and the
adapt to the change.
And the institution will support it. That one of the things I learned years ago, I came out of an education background, and there's a lot of research on how people learn, and research that demonstrates that when you are made to feel just a little bit uncomfortable, like you're just kind of slightly out of your comfort zone, that's when you stand the greatest capacity for learning something new or being creative, thinking creatively about something. I'm not talking deer in the headlights kind of petrified, because that doesn't work so well. But so, you know, I had to learn to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, because that's when I can start asking myself the right questions about, you know, well, how should we do it this way still, you know? So
I think... Sorry, Marie.
That's fair. I was just going to ask if there's anything else that people stop doing. other than what you've already mentioned?
There are some things that people have stopped doing. Boy, I should probably compile this list. And sometimes it varies from one individual to the next. We did back away from... they used to go after these freshman seminars in terms of instruction. There are hundreds of freshman seminars that get taught on campus. And I suggested to people that they not go after those. Now, if somebody comes to us and they've got good reason, we'll work with a faculty member. But if you're trying to do things programmatically, you know, you're trying to figure out where the best places to touch students, and these one-shot freshman seminars were not it. And they were taking a lot of our time. And so we took a step back and said, okay, we're not going to do those anymore. So that was one more thing. The collections obviously is big. Oh, they used to do processing things that they don't do anymore. So librarians used to make binding decisions, title by title binding decisions on some of the serials. Yeah, I know. So we don't have them doing that anymore. They used to spend more time making tech services related decisions. Lots and lots of decisions related to how technical services would handle things. And instead we've standardized a lot of the procedures and policies around that, and the librarians don't do that at all anymore.
Like making decisions about damaged books?
Right. Yep, we don't do that.
So that must be a great kind of counterbalance to the anxiety of new challenges.
Yeah.
But look at what you get not to.
Right, exactly. And you know, depending on the person, some of them like doing those things, but it gives new opportunities to the staff who now get to do more of those things, and they have greater levels of responsibility. So. Yeah. So there are lots of little things like that that people gave up, but we really need to find a few more big things where we can say, these are handoffs. Yeah.
What are you doing in terms of promoting end user independence, technically speaking, as opposed to relentless instruction?
Right. That's a fabulous question. We are trying to do a lot in that arena, but there's always so much more to do. So we did, for example, we've developed a series of online tutorials. The impetus there was that we work very closely with the first year writing, and that was a place where we thought we needed to be because students on our campus can't opt out of it. You know, as part of this new student learning outcomes thing, they also made a decision that you can't... you used to be able to clap out, or what do we call it? I don't know what you call it here. If you took a course somewhere else, or you could do a piece of writing to demonstrate you at a certain level,
you got credit,
right? Well, that doesn't happen anymore. So all the freshmen have to take the first year writing course, okay? And so we had this series called Unravel the Library, which are walk-in workshops. But again, 5,000 to 6,000 new freshmen a year, we couldn't keep up. And so we do still have the workshops, but we developed the online tutorials that go along with them, and those students now get to choose whether they come in or they take a tutorial. The nice thing about the online tutorials is that they're then available to anybody. So any student along the way, maybe transfer students came in their junior year, they could also take advantage of those tutorials. Okay, so we're trying to increase that kind of thing. We're also trying to, what's the word for this? Failure points. We're trying to analyze failure points, like, for example, in the online catalog and on our website, to figure out where things go wrong and how do we intervene so that they don't go wrong. And the obvious example they gave me when they talked about starting this was several years ago. They recognized that when people would approach the online catalog and there's the search box and they would type in JSTOR, and there's one book on JSTOR, you know, and, so, and they would get this single book on JSTOR, but the vast majority of people don't want that book on JSTOR, they want JSTOR, right? So now
why that whole discovery layer.
Exactly. Yeah, it's fabulous. So now if you type JSTOR in that search box, you're taken right to JSTOR. You don't get that book anymore. So that was an intervention. the whole discovery thing, we clearly understand that we are not discovery, this point of the discovery for most folks. They don't start with our website. They don't start with our online catalog. They start somewhere else. So what can we do to enhance, find them where they are and enhance what they're doing there? Yeah. We're trying a lot of things. The assignment calculator that I mentioned, we've got several other tools like that, but there's so much more work to be done there. Yeah. Do you guys have stuff like that you're working on?
Yeah. We're discovery layer.
Yes, we are too.
Are you evaluating what students think about all these things you're doing? The tutorials.
Yes. Yeah, we do. Yeah, the tutorials, they loved it. The students who chose it loved it. Now, I'll tell you, since it's confession time, that it kind of backfired in that the faculty, you know, in that first year writing program, were supposed to assign either the walk-in workshop or the tutorial or tell students they had the choice, and they did. And so about half of them did the walk-in, about half of them did the tutorial. But then the faculty said to the ones who did the tutorial, well, since you didn't do the walk-in workshop for Unravel 2, it's called, pick Unravel 1 or 3 and go into the library and take them. So that increased. The number of students coming to take those increased. Mm-hmm. So clearly we've got our work cut out for us here. We've got to work more closely with the faculty to figure out.
And are the tutorials you're making generic enough that they don't need to be tweaked every time every little change in every catalog and database happens?
Well, they're going to have to be kept current.
We were
in the process of hiring an instructional designer when we had the pause, the university's hiring pause. So we will be, but indeed, they will need to be kept current. But the other thing that we've done, the InfoLit Collaborative has created a toolkit for the librarians, and we've asked all of the librarians to put the things that they're developing into the toolkit so that others can draw on them. So if you develop a tutorial for the catalog and you use your disciplinary examples, somebody else could take it and just substitute disciplinary examples and not have to start from scratch. So that's brand new too, but so far it's working well. And I'm keeping you guys over time here. I'm sorry about that.
If no one has any more questions, I just want to thank you all for coming and paying such good attention.
Yeah, so nice to meet you.
I'm going to take Karen.